30 years ago this week, Marion McPartland's Piano Jazz debuted on National Public Radio. Nearly 700 shows later, Piano Jazz is still going strong. To celebrate Public Radio's longest-running and most listened-to jazz performance show, we present Marion's very first program from 1979. Her guest was Dr. Billy Taylor.
Time since I've heard that piece, and it's great to have you here.
It was nice to be here, Marion. It's good to see you. And
thank you. You know, that that tune takes me back to, I think, as far back as the Hickory House, because you've always used that as a theme, haven't you?
For a long time. I used to use it on the radio as my opening theme, and then we used to play with the trio a lot, because I just like the minor blues. You know?
I know you do.
Do you play the minor blues at all?
Sure. Like yeah. Sure, all the time. Different tunes that have names to them, but it's still the minor blues when you get down to it, and things like that.
I was never aware of the minor blues as an entity till I went to France, and a pianist said, would you play the blues in minor? And I had never thought about the blues in major or minor, you know, and all of a sudden I found playing in minor was quite different from playing it in major, and I've been doing it ever since. It's a whole different kind of, for me, it's a whole different kind of structure.
Well, and also depending on what key you play it in, too. I mean, if you play like blues in G minor, is one kind of a sets up one kind of a vibration, and if you went to D flat or something, it would be a whole other
something
thing.
Something else entirely.
No, I love the minor blues. I'm just trying to think of the one I like, the Oscar Pettiford thing, a Bohemian Rhapsody.
Oh that's nice.
And
he wrote some great tunes.
I know he did. My God, well, listen, you've written some great tunes. I don't see. Any point in waiting too long to have you do one?
Which one would
you like to do?
Well, this is a tune I wrote some time ago. It was based on improvisation. We were asked to play at a dinner some years ago, and it was for the a group called the National Council for the Arts and Government. And every time you do something like that, you always get some wise guy, and he says, "Can't you improvise something on our initials, NCAG?" And so, obviously, we couldn't do anything with the N, but the CAG we made up a tune on, and it sounds like this.
Thank you. goodness, that is really terrific. And you know, I was thinking while you were playing this with things, I heard all those free things, and you did some wild stuff. Did the people at that meeting, did they appreciate all those?
No. When
well,
we left
I
the melody,
sure did.
We were lost.
Yeah, but you started with it, and you came back to it, you know. But it isn't something they could exactly sing or whistle along with, thank God.
Well, yeah, right. Well, they enjoyed it. But, I mean, it really interests me when you play for groups like that. Someone always says, well, improvise something, but they really don't want you. They want you to play around with a melody, you know, take something that they know and kind of go into it and play around it. So on a couple of occasions, I've gotten into a happy birthday or something that I knew they knew. I said, well, you want to improvise? Here's the melody.
You know? It's funny, actually. The word improvise is getting almost to be a dirty word because you say improvise to kids, or why don't you improvise something? And they kind of clam up and get nervous, and especially classical players. Do you find that?
Very much so. As a matter of fact, in the conservatory type training, that's one of the things that I find most objectionable because it's distilled from the training of people. People who go into music school able to improvise come out not knowing how to anymore. In teaching, I find that one way to deal with kids is to refer to the process of improvisation like a conversation. And the conversation we're having now certainly could be done, you know, on a musical level. I mean, you could play something, I could play something. And, you know, that kind of thing happens all the time. And yet, when you say that to a student, the student quite frequently does freeze up and says, well, no, I wouldn't sit down at the piano. I'll wait till I go home and practice or something and get it together. And that's too bad.
It is. This reminded me of something else, of the great composers years ago. Now, didn't they all have parts in the music, like the cadenza part that's all written out that you're supposed to play as is? Years ago, they had their own cadenza.
Well, not only that, but Bach and Mozart and many of the pianists who were composers didn't write out the piano part. They just wrote out the figured bass, which is just like our chord changes. And so they would write something for the choir or for the other instruments to play, but the piano score at that point was just figured bass so that they knew what was going on and could play around it. But they didn't write out nobody. Who had time to every Sunday write out a whole piano part for the, or clavier part or whatever, you know?
Well, I think they should bring that back in the schools. I mean, even for just strictly classical music, they should be required to play an extemporaneous part somewhere.
I agree, because that certainly is where the personal, one of the places where the personal dimension enters, and it's quite obvious when you listen to some of the young people improvise that they're quite good at it, and they've, despite the restrictions, have learned to do some of the things that are a part of the vocabulary that we use.
You know, maybe we could set up a little of that jazz conversation with this one.
Thank you.
Ooh, gosh, that was fun.
Hey, that was.
There will be more talk and music in a minute. This 30-year anniversary episode of Marian McPartland's Piano Jazz with guest Dr. Billy Taylor was the very first Piano Jazz program. Piano Jazz is made possible in part by the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art.
Something I was thinking about with regard to, well, not only that tune, but other tunes. So many people ask me about voicings and the way you voice that tune. Such great chords, but you don't sit down and figure them out. I mean, do you play the tunes through, or do you just maybe take a tune that you haven't played and play it?
I do something that, I don't know, I guess it stemmed from hanging out with Art Tatum a lot. I found that when I was a kid, I first came to New York, and I got to know Tatum quite well. And one of the ways that he would jam was a guy named Clarence Prophet. And the of them would jam, and instead of improvising on the melody, they would improvise on the harmony. So they'd take the same tune and reharmonize it each time they played it. And it just blew my mind. I mean, you know, like each four or five chords, after you pass the second chorus, I mean, what are you going to do, you know? And there was something else. Well, so I got in the habit of trying to do those kind of things.
I really wish some of these kids that we both play for could have heard Art Tatum in the flesh.
He was marvelous. You know, he played very interesting things from the European classical repertoire. He played Chopin. He played other
really?
Things. Yeah, played quite well.
I can imagine. Well, of course, that famous thing that I learned when I was in England was the jazz humoresque.
Yeah,
you know?
Right. Yeah. Yeah, right.
That thing that he did. Yeah. I thought that was fabulous.
It
I couldn't
was,
wait to sit down and try to... Of course, I never could get that feeling that he had, but I did try to play that. How about a piece... You mentioned something about your Tatum bag, and I'm wondering how this tune is going to sound. I didn't know what time it was.
Yeah, well, this is something that... whenever I think of him, for some reason or other, I don't think he ever recorded it, but I used to just like the way he did it. And so I started doing it along those lines.
Thank you. That is terrific. And you know, you could play all those tenths. How far can you span a tenth?
Only about just a little beyond a tenth. It took a lot of work. As a matter of fact, my hand's really not that large. I envy guys like UB Blake and Ellis Locke and these guys with these fantastically big hands. But I had to learn to, you know, do those kind of things.
You made all these things come off.
Yeah.
You know, I have to cheat on those.
Oh, yeah?
I just can't.
Oh, no, I had to work on that.
That's well, I tried, but I just couldn't make it. I just used to sort of do exercises and pull my thumb up as hard as I could, and it just wouldn't go to that next note. Well, now when you first came to New York, I'm trying to think where I first saw you. In fact, I saw you in the same place that I saw Mary Lou Williams at the Downbeat.
Yeah,
you were sort of house pianist
there,
weren't you? And so many fantastic musicians came in and out of that place.
It's a fantastic place. As a matter of fact, Monty Kay, who ran it with Irv Levy, used to book Birdland, and so a lot of the guys that worked at Birdland from time to time worked there. He had the Modern Jazz Sextet, which was the predecessor of the Modern Jazz Quartet, with Miles and JJ in the front line.
And
it was, you know, it was really a dynamite group. And then they had Dizzy brought Candido in one time, and he said, "Billy, I got this great drummer. I'd like to sit in." I said, "I already got a drummer. I got a trio. What am I going to do with another drummer?" He said, "Oh no, he plays just. You've never heard a percussionist like this. You got to hear him." So he came in and sat in and stayed for 6 months.
And then also at Birdland too, I guess. I'm trying to just remember where this was, probably in the early 50s, because I opened at the Hickory House in 1952.
And put a padlock on the door. Nobody else could get in for about
well,
7 years.
I don't know. You had a pretty long stay there.
That was after.
But I used to, you know, we had half-hour sets, and he was very insistent about this. And they had a girl piano player playing in between. And at the end of our set, we'd put on our coats and dash over there to Birdland. And a lot of times you were there playing with, I don't know who, Dizzy.
Everybody. I was house pianist, so I used to get to play with everybody. Play with Bird, play with whatever the all-star group was, Oscar Pettiford or Zoot Sims or Kai Winding or whoever, you know. I was a piano player, so it was fun.
Well, but that really gives you such a wide scope of how to play for different people, because I imagine you learned about 9,000 different ways to comp, didn't you?
Different things, don't they? That was really where I learned to comp, because when I first came to New York, I had developed a way of comping, which became the way a little later. But I heard Ellington do something which seemed the exact logical way to get out of the way of the bass player.
Oh, his comping and was unbelievable.
It was marvelous.
Unbelievable.
You know, he did that kind of thing. And, you know, the bass was down here doing whatever he was doing. And you were out of his way. So I developed, you know, things based on that. And I got on everybody's nerves. I was working with Ben Webster, who loved it. And all the other tenor players hated it. But it was amazing to me that about, maybe 8 or 10 years later, everybody was doing that. So, it just became, that was what you do.
Sure, but I don't know. I've tried to vary it from chorus to chorus, to sort of try to pretend I'm playing a big band chorus or something, do something down in here, and then maybe. But the way you do it is you could really, and you probably have given whole courses on comping.
Well, there was a record that I made, and I hate to think about how long ago this was, but it was at a town hall concert with Stuff Smith. And it was just Stuff, Ted Sturgis on bass.
Ted Sturgis, and, Mohawk.
And Mohawk.
Oh, playing bass. He's now at Jimmy Ryan's.
Jimmy Ryan.
Yeah.
And just the three of us. And we had, Stuff was such a swinging player that you didn't need any drums. And, I mean, we played Bugle Call Rag, and we played a couple of other things. And I listen to that record now. I play it, you know, when I'm trying to talk to classes about how some types of comping are done. And that way, you were saying big band. That's exactly what I had in mind. Those kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you're thinking brass section or ensemble or whatever.
Right.
And so that was what he wanted. And he sounded like a whole reed section with the violin.
You know, I just thought of something, Billy. We've been talking so much about comping. And I guess because we both know what it is, we figure everybody else does. I guess are some people out there. Yeah, well, that's somebody that might say, what the heck is comping? And you can go ahead and describe it because you're much better educated than I am.
Well, I don't know about all that, but idea of accompanying oneself, especially, for instance, you know, in playing stride piano, that's a kind of comping because what you're doing is setting both a harmonic and a rhythmic background. And what we are doing for one another when we're playing, where we're playing both the bass line and a kind of a harmonic thing.
Well, actually, comping is a sort of a taken from the word accompanying, isn't it?
Yeah,
that's probably
absolutely
how it started out, accompanying. Yeah. And then it just got to be too long a word. Nobody wanted to say that. So comping is a...
It's an accompaniment. And the way that one would do that when one has a bass and drums and other instruments... in playing in other parts of the piano.
I could try to play a bass line and let you play something against that.
Okay. Well, actually, when you the harmonic background that you set up, and in jazz, the harmonic background always has some specific rhythmic input. So it's not just harmony alone; it has a rhythmic feeling. So that's all a part of the accompaniment.
And also, I think sometimes people think that comping is another way of making themselves heard. Like not everybody realizes that comping is the thing that's supposed to make the soloist feel good, or if you lose your place in the tune, you can listen to what's going on behind you and say, oh, there it is.
In a lot of cases, you can't. You say, I wonder where it is,
or where was it? What should we do? What would you like to do?
Oh, I don't know. Let's do something together. What,
all right. Well, let's see. It's that tune of yours that I love so much. I don't know when you wrote this thing, but you used to play it with our old rhythm section. I say ours because we both used Ben Tucker and Dave Bailey, remember?
Right, sure.
And you did this tune. It's called Capricious.
Yeah.
Can we do that?
Sure. Love to.
Okay. Thank you. I love that thing. It's got the cutest melody. Just so nice.
Well, actually, that came out of a trip that Dave and Ben made to South America. And they kept telling me about the bossa nova and the stuff that was happening in the samba down there. And they said how close it was to jazz. So originally that was written as a bossa nova. But we play it in all kinds of contexts.
I seem to remember because I remember hearing it going.
Yeah, it was slower. Oh, sure. Yeah.
We're hearing you do it with them. But that is a very groovy tune. Cute is the wrong word. It's that's a tune, in fact.
You're right.
That's something else altogether. But you've got, for me, playing two pianos is almost like playing a golf game or something. You really get to know something about people when you play two pianos that you didn't know before. Like you hear somebody play and you say, gee, they sound great. And then when you play two pianos with the person, like I with you today, that you just know certain things about the time and the definition and the listening quality that you have and how you're sensitive to laying out in a certain place where I'm going to play, and I hope vice versa, but it really takes a lot of listening.
Oh, it's a two-way street, sure. I mean, I can't do that unless you do. And, so it just in any thing that you do together, there's a give and take thing. And I think that's one of the exciting things about jazz. And unfortunately, pianists don't get a chance to do it as often as perhaps we should because just like you were saying in hearing things in Herbie's work and hearing in other pianists, I hear in your work a lot of things. And speaking of the change over the period that I've been listening to you, it's just marvelous to hear your touch has changed. A lot of the things that you do are, they're contemporary and they're you, which is, I think, what jazz is about. I remember not long ago we were down at the Village Vanguard listening to Thad Jones and Mel Lewis's band, and they had an arrangement of a tune that you wrote. I guess it was a title tune of one of your albums, because I liked the tune very much, but I'd never heard that particular arrangement. Did you make the arrangement?
No, I could never make an arrangement like that, Billy. As a matter of fact, Jerry Dodgen did it, quite unbeknownst to me, because this is what happened with this tune. They asked me to do a thing for Downbeat. So I thought, well, I might as well do something on one of my own tunes. So I wrote out the tune and then a couple of little ideas for improvisation, how to play the tune, what the bass player would play, and how you could voice it, how you could change the chords. And Jerry read it, and he liked the tune, and he made the arrangement, and they recorded it, and I didn't know a thing about it. So one night, in the middle of the night, I get this phone call, and it's Jerry Dodgen. Hey, we just recorded your tune. What? Ambience, so I almost died, the adrenaline shot up. I didn't sleep a wink for the rest of the night. So the fact that they recorded it, really did put the tune on the map.
It's a beautiful tune. Play it, would you play?
I'd love to.
Sure.
Love to. Thank you.
That's really beautiful.
Yeah. Thank you.
It's lovely. You know, that listening to that kind of texture is something that I think is very special as far as jazz is concerned. I think that perhaps jazz pianists are the best listeners for other jazz pianists. And it reminds me of something that used to happen in the when I was very young. There used to be a place uptown in New York called Tom Tillman's Hollywood Bar. And Tatum used to go there, and like all the piano players would go. Nothing but piano players, you know, a little upright in the back. And everybody would go there and play. And guys would just sit for hours listening to one another play. And it wasn't a competitive thing. I mean, in the early days it was, but in, you know, as it settled into a kind of thing, you just go in, you just listen to another guy play. And if you felt like playing, you'd play. Or a woman would come and play. I remember Dottie Donegan came in one time. And, you know, and just sat and played some things. And most of the guys there had only heard her do her act. So they'd heard her in the Roxy and things like that, but they never heard her really play.
She can really
she
play.
She can play, sure. And,
no, I bet nobody said she plays good for a chick.
Believe it.
she is something else. Yeah. But, you know, you reminded me of something with that, because that actually that tune, Ambience, it's one tune that just fell together from... I don't know, driving along one night and working in a school. I always get very productive when I'm working in a school. Hearing Herbie Hancock record, and it wasn't that I was trying to duplicate anything that he did, but just sort of the idea. I don't know, the voicings or something like that. You've got so many things that are coming to my mind now. Like there's one that I recorded, in fact, called Biddy's Beat.
Oh, did you do that? Oh,
yeah, I did that years ago at the London House.
Sure.
To the accompaniment of coffee cups. And,
yeah, I remember the room.
Goodness.
It's a Burger King now.
Oh, that, I know, but isn't that awful? But you know, a lot of times people say, where is there to hear jazz? This place is closed and that place is closed. But I think for every place that has closed, another one opens somewhere else.
Well, there's a whole different thing, as you know. There are a lot of coffee houses, then the whole college scene and the whole school thing is opening up in terms of different spaces for listening. And I'm so spoiled that, you know, I hate to play clubs. I don't play a lot of clubs now. We're playing at a place called the Knickerbocker in New York. But outside of that, I don't play a lot of clubs simply because they're very noisy. And, you know, I've been spoiled with the attention I get in a concert. It's exciting. There is nothing quite like playing, for me, playing to that kind of audience.
There'll be more talk and music in a minute. This is Marion McPartland's Piano Jazz with guest Dr. Billy Taylor. Celebrating 30 years of our broadcast, this is the first Piano Jazz episode, which originally aired in 1979. Piano Jazz is made possible in part by the Friends of Piano Jazz.
Well, now that you're all warmed up and going, let's do that tune of yours.
I Wish I Knew. You like that?
Right.
All right.
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
That's really a ball. Thank you so much. I guess time's up, so that's really a fine way to finish.
Well, Marion, thank you very much for inviting me, and it's always a pleasure to see and hear you, and it's even more fun to play with you.
You've been listening to Piano Jazz with Marion McPartland. Her guest has been Dr. Billy Taylor in this first episode of Piano Jazz, which aired in 1979. Piano Jazz is a production of South Carolina ETV and Radio. The producer is Dick Phipps, recording engineer John Gelinas. Editor Tom Sheely, executive producer William D. Hay. Support for Piano Jazz comes from Save America's Treasures through a partnership between the National Endowment for the Arts and the National Park Service Department of the Interior. This episode was made possible originally by Dixie Electronics, the National Endowment for the Arts, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and NPR. Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and NPR. Contributors include the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, celebrating 10 years of support for the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.